Welcome back to the program. I'm Michael Cohen. This is 1320 WILS. The sexual revolution may be applauded by the women's liberation movement, but at least one woman is questioning the societal results over these many years. Mary Eberstadt is a research fellow at the Hoover Institute and the author of the new book, Adam and Eve After the Pill, Paradoxes of the Sexual Revolution. She joins us now to talk about her conclusions. Mary, thanks for coming on the program this evening.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
I guess one of the striking things is that even after the pill, we still have so many abortions and unwanted pregnancies here in the U.S. Why do you think that with so many contraception choices, that is still the case?
Well, I think that's one of the paradoxes of the sexual revolution, is that the pill and related devices were supposed to liberate women from their fertility. But instead, I think, and I argue in the book, there's been a general lowering of the standards of the esteem in which women are held and in which children are held. And I think that that is directly traceable to the pill, which essentially flooded the sexual marketplace and made the choosing of a romantic partner more like the choosing of a commodity than it had been before.
Well, the idea of having a choice of when and with whom to have a child seems like a fundamental one that a woman would probably not want to give up. Do you agree that for many women, birth control has led to a better life?
Well, that's not the impression that you get if you really get on the ground and read their literature and look at what they say about relationships today. You know, there have been a slew of books, and I want to emphasize that these are not coming from a religious point of view, but from a secular point of view, talking about the end of marriage and why don't women just raise children on their own, and talking about how toxic relations have gotten between the sexes. And I think that in that sense, you could say things are worse now for many people. I'm not speaking for all people. But as far as other kinds of evidence for that claim goes, there is a major study out there that was released a couple years ago by two Wharton School economists. And it was called, appropriately enough, the paradox of declining female happiness. And this was based on surveys of thousands of women, not only in America, but across the Western world over the last 35 years. And the authors of this study talk about how they cannot account for the fact that over time, it looks as if women's happiness is going down. Now, why should this be, as they say? After all, women are better educated now. They're in the paid marketplace more than they used to be. They can control their fertility. So what's going on that's making them more miserable than they used to be? And part of the answer I provide in the book is maybe, just maybe, the pill and associated devices has made relations between the sexes more problematic than they used to be.
Well, what about those that say that there have always been problems when it comes to relationships, and the difference is that women were much more repressed and did not have a voice in the past, and that is something they now have and are expressing themselves more?
Yeah, that's certainly a point of view, and it's one that a lot of people believe. But on the other hand, I'm not the only person out there arguing that the sexual revolution has really changed the playing field between the sexes. A few years back, a perfectly secular sociologist named Lionel Tiger argued in a book called The Decline of Males that if you take away reproductive power from males altogether, that is, if you concentrate it in women, what you're going to have is a situation where men, who are already less sort of tethered to the domestic front than women, they're just going to float away. They're going to be marginalized and made to feel irrelevant. And what he predicted was there will be more family breakup, there will be more out-of-wedlock births. Again, this is a sociologist who says that religion is a toxic issue. As far as he's concerned, this isn't coming from a religious point of view. So all I'm saying is that there's a lot of secular evidence out there, and I tried to put it together in this book, to suggest that there are new problems in romance and in family life that are traceable to the pill.
I'm talking to Mary Eberstadt. She's a research fellow at the Hoover Institute and the author of the new book, Adam and Eve After the Pill, Paradoxes of the Sexual Revolution. Well, in fact, Mary, you do focus on men in one of the chapters of your book. And you look at what the sexual revolution is doing to men, although really isn't it what high-speed internet access might be doing to men nowadays?
Well, that's a good question. But the pill, by destigmatizing, say, non-marital sexual activity, is connected to pornography that way. Now, pornography these days is talked about as a kind of victimless situation, or at least there's a lot of libertarian feeling out there that this ought to be off limits for debate. Is it a problem or isn't it? Well, I think that in a really interesting way, you can draw an analogy to smoking. That just as 50 years ago, a lot of people thought that smoking wasn't a problem, and smoking was everywhere. Lots of people did it, and the people who objected to it were in the minority. I think something like that is what's happening with pornography today, which is why I focus not so much on the men as on the therapists who report that they are seeing addiction problems that they didn't used to see, and on, for example, the Association of Matrimonial Lawyers reporting that internet pornography is increasingly a factor in divorces. So these, to me, are kinds of, again, secular forms of evidence of harm created by the substance.
In the book, you ask the question, is food the new sex? What do you mean by that?
There's a whole chapter about something else I think is really neat, which is the way in which, over the last, say, 50 years, we've gotten, as a society in the West, we've gotten less moralistic about sex and more moralistic about food. You know, a lot of people think that food choices are moral choices, and a lot of people don't think anymore that sexual choices are moral choices in the same way. And what I argue is that I think these things are connected, and it seems like we've taken our taboos or our hang-ups or however you want to describe them about sex and transferred them onto the realm of food.
You also ask a question that, well, a lot of men want to know the answer to. What does woman want? Is it fair to assume, though, that women generally all want the same thing?
Well, I don't think that's fair, and that's why I think that contemporary talk about a war against women is kind of nonsense, because women are not a monolith. Women are rational creatures, just like men are. And in putting this book out there, what I'm trying to do is use secular evidence to appeal to reason. So, no, I don't think all women think alike or want the same thing.
What do you think the fundamental desires, though, of women are?
Well, the same as those of men in many ways. I mean, I think most people would like to have warm, loving relationships with other people, and intimacy, with other people. And insofar as the world since the sexual revolution interferes with those things, I think that it's fair to point that out.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from women? I'm guessing some have been less than positive.
I really haven't gotten much reaction from women writing in, you know, as women. Again, I think opinion is divided out there, and that they have the use of their reason just like men do.
Ultimately, though, do you argue or do you feel that a more traditional society would be a better one for women?
Well, what I argue in the book is that we've had for 50 years the sexual liberationists have essentially written the legacy of the sexual revolution. And it's been largely a positive legacy as they see it. What I'm trying to do is point out that there's a lot of evidence out there that this legacy has a dark side, and that it's been harder on children, harder on men, harder on women than is generally understood. So that's the overall point that I'm trying to get at with the book.
But what about the financial realities in today's world that are maybe separate from the effects of the sexual revolution, which are that nowadays both partners have to work, and there is kind of a forced equality on that level?
I think that it's really kind of implausible to argue that people are worse off now than they ever were. People manage to figure out their financial lives alongside their family lives, and you know, we are, on balance, the most prosperous society in the history of the world, recession notwithstanding. So I don't think the argument that people are so immiserated that they can't possibly think about having children is one that really holds up to empirical scrutiny.
What do you think, though, when you see these old world traditional societies like in the Middle East, where you know, they're holding on to a very traditional viewpoint where women are certainly much more repressed than in a society like our own?
I'm certainly not defending the repression of women in other societies or anywhere. What I'm saying is that the force that was fed by feminists and lots of other people to liberate women, namely control over their fertility, has had an unexpected downside, which is that it's made many women more unhappy than they used to be.
Do you think within the current structure of our equal society that women could be made more happy with some adjustments?
Well, here's what I think. We are only 50 years into this experiment of the sexual revolution, and, you know, we tend to take it for granted because for most people right now, middle-aged and younger, this is how the world always was, right? But in terms of the sweep of human history, this is a pretty new phenomenon. And as in the example of tobacco, as in the example of other large social experiments, including, say, communism, it's going to take time for the actual legacy of this social revolution to percolate down. People are going to have to look at the evidence and make up their own minds about whether this has been a good or bad thing for society or in their own personal lives. I think that process is just beginning.
Do you view this as a permanent change for our society? I mean, certainly contraception can't be reversed, but do you think that there could be a time where some of the liberation of women could be reversed here in America?
Well, I think that any time you start calling a social movement inevitable, you better watch out because something's going to happen to contradict you. You know, Marxism claimed inevitability on its side. Freudians claimed a certain inevitability in their understanding of the human psyche. Some people thought that smoking was here forever. After all, it had been going on for hundreds of years, and no one could imagine restigmatizing it the way it had now restigmatized. So all I'm saying is that the sexual revolution is not in a category all by itself. It's not impossible that people will come to rethink it and to have a different understanding of it and to practice it differently.
Mary Eberstadt, a research fellow at the Hoover Institute, and check out her new book, Adam and Eve After the Pill, Paradoxes of the Sexual Revolution. Mary, thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks very much for having me, Michael.
And we're coming right back. I'm Michael Cohen with producer James Platy, and this is 1320 WILS.